Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us. Welcome back to the program. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Charles Johnson. Of course, Charles Johnson, the author of a National Book Award winner for his novel Middle Passage, one of the great books, I think, of all time, novelist, essayist, literary critic, professor emeritus, University of Washington, Seattle. And he's been on the show over the last year with talking about his conversations with Ethelbert Miller, which was just incredible. That's coming out in January as an ebook. But he and his daughter, Elisheba Johnson, have written this new incredible book called The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy, Science, Wonder. Bending Time is the name of this first. It's going to be a series. And Charles Johnson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. How are you doing?
Pretty good. It's kind of early here.
It is. That's why I deeply appreciate you getting up to do this.
Yeah. I wouldn't miss an opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet at Mark Steiner. Log on to Facebook, any one of our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. I'm supposed to say also that support for WEA is provided by Exxon and Mobil Fuels. More information available at fuelingconnections.com. So, we are here with Charles Johnson. And this was a little different twist. I mean, first of all, I never knew that you were an illustrator until this book.
I have been a professional cartoonist since I was 17 years old in 1965. And I spent 7 years doing that. I produced two books of collections of political cartoons and satire. One was called Black Humor in 1970, published by the Johnson Publication Company in Chicago. They do Ebony Jet, Black World, so forth. And the other one was called Half Past Asian Time, published in 1972. The second book's kind of hard to find. It was published by a fly-by-night company called Aware Press in California. But I also, in 1970, did a TV show for PBS called Charlie's Pad, where I was host, co-producer, and creator. And I taught people how to draw. I still get mail from people who learned as a kid to draw from that show. And then they draw for their own children now.
You know, here's what blew my mind before you get right into the book here, that until I saw the back of the book that you sent for me to read, and I saw Charlie's Pad on the back of the book, I remember that show.
You do?
Absolutely remember that show. And so but I never put the things together in my head that the Chuck Johnson philosopher writer is the same Charles Johnson who did Charlie's Pad.
I've had to reinvent myself maybe three times, Mark. No, seriously. It was broadcast nationally. We did 52 shows, 15 minutes each, where I taught a different aspect of cartooning. And I love those days of my life, but, cartoonists don't get paid very well. So I had to reinvent myself as a scholar, and a college professor. I'm retired now after 33 years in the classroom. So I just spent all my time creating, and this was a joy for me to do because I could get back to drawing. Now, I have to tell you something. I did those drawings, 10 for the book, in 18 days and nights.
Wow.
We had originally had another illustrator, but she had personal problems and bailed out at the end of July. So to stay on schedule for an October release, I just put everything out of my life and drew for 18 days. So, a couple of the drawings I might want to do again, the first one or two, but I think it turned out pretty well.
I think it did, too. I love the drawings in this book, and I love the book. I mean, before we get into the heart of this book, just very quickly, did you write the book with your daughter, Elisheba, or did she write the book?
Yes. We spent the month of November of last year plotting it, outlining it, and then I sat down and for two intense months, like I was in a dream, writing the draft, early drafts, and she would go over every draft with revisions and additions. So, dialogue, description, the opening scene, so much of the book is hers as well as mine.
Well, you've created some interesting characters in this book, and I love the way it opened up, too, with a lunch lady and what you came up with. The first thing was what you all were thinking when you came up with Mom's Mabley Elementary, Red Fox Middle School, and Richard Pryor High School.
Absolutely. All the schools in this school district are named after black comedians.
Maybe there's a lot of folks who don't know Mom's Mabley anymore from back.
You know, that's true, unfortunately. That's true. I think Richard Pryor is more recognizable. Maybe Red Fox, but Moms Mabley was a great comedian.
So this main character, Emory Jones.
Emory Jones.
Middle school kid. Genius.
Yep. He, you know, we have lots of black child prodigies out there in the world, and they never get profiled or attention. You know, if your listeners will go to our website, which is emorysadventures.com, and there's no apostrophe in Emory, it's just emorysadventures.com, we have a science blog that we've added in which we have articles about, there's a young woman named Thessalonica Arzu Imbre. She's 14. She graduated from college at 14. Her IQ is 199, higher than Einstein. We also have articles on time travel, on robots, and AI, artificial intelligence. And we have a TED Talk by Patricia Kuhl on how babies acquire language. You know, she argues that babies are all natural geniuses until the age of 7. So I've been, this is a character I've wanted to create for 30 years. Someone like Emory Jones, who is a child prodigy, scientific whiz kid, who is always getting into adventures of one kind or another involving an aspect of science. Now, in this book, we look at time, you know, and time travel. The next book, we'll look at, you know, a different subject. And the goal here is to get kids excited. And this is not just for kids, by the way. It's for adults as well. It's for the kid, I think, in all of us who have a, you know, who still hunger with that sense of wonder and mystery, you know, about the universe, right? And every book then is going to focus on something different in terms of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM fields, STEM education, which I believe is really important, and as our president Obama does too, for the future. You know, we really have to get kids excited, I think, about science, which is exciting. But what's happening right now, I think, in the sciences is more exciting than any other field, whether you're talking about medical technology or astrophysics or nanotechnology. Week by week by week, we're seeing discoveries that are changing the world in which we live. All of it, the furniture of our world, how we live, it's just amazing. And some of that I want to capture because it, science itself, today, I think promoting that sense of wonder and mystery,
and it, I think that's part of what you do in this book as well. I mean, one of the things that you kind of list his heroes in this book,
yes,
which I really love the heroes that you decided to pick out, and they're important. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson and the physicist people in them probably never heard of Ronald Mallett.
Ronald L. Mallett.
Mallett.
He is an astrophysicist who has come up with a theory of time travel that everybody apparently says in the scientific community is credible. You know, he's got to do experimentation and testing. Now, I read his book, Time Traveler, in one nine-hour intense sitting.
Wow.
So the theory of time travel in this book that Emory Jones, you know, operates with is Dr. Mallett's theory. And then also, you got to mention, there's a drawing in there where Emory Jones has a poster of one of his heroes.
Yes.
And it's Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I think I did a pretty good caricature of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
You did. You, I'm looking at it right now, and you did.
You can tell it's him. I mean, he's pretty easy because of, you know, his mustache and so forth. He's a very distinctive guy. And, you know, I think he's taking over the hosting of the old Cosmos series.
He is. I read the same thing.
Yeah,
the Carl Sagan position.
Yep, that's right.
And you mentioned also in the book, I want to get into something else here, but Marcello Pellegrino Arnetti, who also was this kind of, who's this famous Roman Catholic priest exorcist who did exorcisms, but also said he did time travel and actually saw. So that was interesting. You put that in there.
You know, I discovered that after I wrote the manuscript.
Uh huh.
I was kind of looking around and I came across this thing that referred to a chronovisor that had been invented by him and suppressed by the Vatican. But according to him, now this is kind of like urban legend, right, or something, or world legend, he looked back in time and saw performances during the era maybe of the ancient Athenians, the crucifixion of Christ, and so forth and so on. So out there in the world, there is a mythology about chronovisors, viewing machines for seeing into the past.
So,
isn't that crazy?
It's insane. But let me get into these characters. I mean, I love what you built here because part of the book is also about what we do to the other, whether it's Gwen,
yes.
the Emery's girlfriend who is deaf,
yes.
And Emery being this brilliant kind of kid who is then picked on by these other kids who don't get him and don't get it, and their own kind of stories of pain that you throw in there as well.
Yes. This is my daughter's contribution. She came to me and she said, you know, why don't you want to do a children's book with me? Last year, I said, well, I do, but we got to have a story. What do you want to focus on? She wanted to focus on the widespread and tragic phenomena of bullying. She was bullied as a kid. I was bullied as a kid.
I was bullied as a kid. I know that feeling.
Now, a lot of kids were. And a lot of kids, as one of my friends pointed out to me recently, they feel like outsiders. They
right.
feel like outsiders when they're in elementary school, maybe middle school. So both of these two kids, Emery and Gabby, who narrates the story, his friend, Gabby has a disability, a hearing loss. And you might say Emery has a disability, too, because he's got this huge IQ and he's a genius, right? So it causes social problems. They're both kind of like outsiders, and a lot of people relate to that, adults as well as, I think, kids, too.
You still there?
Hello?
Yeah, we were here. That was just my hand hitting my own microphone. I apologize.
That's all right. Believe me, I'm on my second cup of coffee here, too.
But I think that was an important kind of subplot in this book that was kind of critical to the story.
It is critical. You know, I don't know if anybody's pointed it out yet. If you go to Amazon, you'll see reader comments, and everybody focuses on that sense of, you know, a kid feeling that they're different and how important it is that they understand their integrity, you know, based upon their difference. But nobody's pointed out yet that this is a story. It's like a lot of my former stories, my novels. There's a core emotional thing here that deals with black fathers and sons.
Yes.
You know, Emery's got a problem with his dad, who is kind of anti-intellectual. And then the bully, Chippy, he's got a problem with his dad, which I won't reveal to listeners, because it's a really important moment, which Emery discovers when they're back in the Triassic period. But I've always been concerned with that issue, fathers and sons, having been a son, you know, being a father, you know, and what that dynamic is all about. So there's lots of different layers, I hope, in the book. And people have been telling me, and I don't know if this is true or not,
that
this is the first fiction collaboration by a black father and daughter.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that at Seattle University when I was there a week ago Monday, you know, doing an event. Somebody said that to me. So I've been asking friends about it, my agent, and they all seem to say, yeah, that's true. So we weren't thinking about creating a historical moment, you know, with a book, you know, daddy-daughter book. But it may be the case. If you know any other titles, please let me know.
I will look that up, but I think you could be right. I want to read one of the, if you don't mind, it'll take me about a minute or two to read what one of the readers of this book posted.
Oh, please do.
Because I think it will give our listeners a sense of what this book is about. Mm-hmm. She wrote, I love the adventures of Emery Jones because it's a perfect mix of messages for my son, that you can be different, brilliant, challenged, and talented all at once, that you have best friends of another gender that are not a crush but rather based on heartfelt affinity, solidarity, integrity, mutual admiration, and trust. The standing up against bullies and protecting your friends is the right thing to do. That black boys do science and it's normal. That good mentorship is essential, and remembering our own cultural icons is powerful inspiration. And that compassion and forgiveness transform pain into victory, transform everything, really. I love how the Johnsons integrate the common for the tween and pre-tween with the things they have to look up. Google to understand how the text is both demanding and affirming at the same time. And as a parent of a little black child, I want to have my son's library full of such stuff. Kudos to the Johnsons for challenging the stereotypes, constraining and confining our possibilities in this culture. Now, that's how I felt reading the book, but she put it better than even I, who like to think I can say something on the air.
Well, I think you succinctly say many things on the air, Mark. But, you know, that one stands out. You know, we've got, like, so far 15 reader comments, 13 are five-star and 2 are four-star. And hers stands out as one of the most trenchant. One of the she just unpacks.
Yes.
You know, so many important elements in the book. Black boys and girls do science, and it is normal. You know, you can have a friend of the other gender, and it doesn't have to be a crush. It can be simply mutual admiration and support that you give to each other, as Emory Jones gives to Gabby. Now, Gabby tells, she's going to tell all the stories, and it's going to be like, you know, Dr. Watson telling all the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Right.
So you always see, you know, you always see Sherlock from the outside. You know, makes him a little more mysterious.
That's right.
Well,
that's
the
right.
Same thing is going to be true of Emory. You're always going to see him through Gabby's perspective, and I love these two kids. I mean, I just love both of them very much. And what's going to happen is they're going to grow. In the next book, they'll be 2 years older.
Uh-huh.
They'll be in middle school. And then we're going to try to do 4 or 5 of them. That's our projection until I'm about 70 years old. and take them up to high school, you know, through high school. And by that time, you'll see how the lives of all these characters have been prepared for their future.
Now, do you then plan as you two write these books over these next 7 books, taking them through high school, that the style of writing will change because they'll be getting older and the audience may be getting older?
I think so. You know, this is my very first venture at a young adult book. And the way I talked to a good friend of mine, Tanya Bolden, who wrote a great quote for the book, she spent 30 years, and she's got many awards doing children's literature. So she gave me some good advice and so forth. She writes, she says, for a very smart, you know, 12-year-old. So the language might change a little bit, but I want to keep it within that young adult range and also entertaining for grown-ups. I know adults who read the book to their children. They read it with their children. And I think that's a very, you know, warm and kind of important experience.
No, I do too. I think that's why this book kind of hits so many points. I think that there are things here when you read it that you just have to ponder, and things like when Emory is talking to one of the kids, and I won't give all that away, but he says he's talking about science, and he talks about why he loves science, and he says,
yeah,
not for any of that. Knowledge is all I have. You take things away from me all the time, but nobody can ever take away what I know or what I can do. I love science because it's about evidence and truth. It doesn't care what color you are or what country or culture you come from. Science is a way of life, a way of thinking about the world.
Exactly. That's one of the most important paragraphs in the book. You know, I'll tell you, Mark, you know, I worked harder, I think, on this book, this story, than almost any story I've done in the past. I've gone over it so many times because I wanted every paragraph to have something special in it, you know, something delightful in it. And you get to that paragraph where Emory is describing to the bully chip, because it starts out when the bully chip, he says, why do you study so hard?
Right.
You know, you always got your head in a book. Are you trying to suck up to the teachers? Is it because you want to make a lot of money or something? And it's not that. It's because knowledge is all he has. Knowledge is delicious. You know, that one line, you can't take away knowledge from me? I think I heard that when I was very young from a survivor of the Holocaust, who said that no matter what the Nazis did to them, they could not take away what he knew.
Hmm.
So I hope it's a very universal application that one statement from Emory has, you know. I'm glad you highlighted that.
Because that sentiment could also, I was thinking about your book, Middle Passage. It fits into the power of somebody who's enslaved, the internal power.
That's right.
Despite what the external circumstance does to you.
That's right. There are certain things that even under those circumstances cannot be taken away from the individual in terms of their integrity, whether it's slavery, whether it's the Holocaust, or any of the tragedies that, you know, descend upon us, and unfortunately still descend upon us. So Emory isn't a child prodigy, scientific whiz kid for egotistical reasons. It's because, you know, knowledge is delicious.
Right.
And also because this is his identity. One of the commentators made a comment that I liked. He said, you know, what's interesting about Emory is that he's a kid with a brain and also an identity that goes beyond just being black.
Yes, right. That identity of being a thinker, a scientist.
That's right.
An inventor.
And we have black scientists out there. You know,
yes.
The history of black inventors and scientists is one of the most invisible, you know, aspects, I think, of American history. All around us, you know, the gas mask that firemen wear,
yes,
that was invented by a black man. But when he presented the idea, he was rejected. He had to have a white man present the idea, and then it was accepted, right? You stop at a stop sign, you know, you can check me out on this.
Well, you're right. Right.
The stoplight was invented, the earliest form of that changing stop sign, by a black person. You know, we go all the way down to the real McCoy, you know, refers to a black inventor, you know. People should do a whole story on this, on black inventors past and present. Now, of course, we have scientists, you know, who are astrophysicists and others, but all the way back, even into the slavery period, we have slaves even making improvements upon farm equipment, you know, essential kinds of things in the lives of people in the 19th century and the early 20th century.
Absolutely. I think that we do this piece at the beginning of our show now called A Day in History, and we've been highlighting some of that, and that's a big piece of it, because you have to bring these things to the fore, these highlighting pieces of our history we don't think about as our own,
mm-hmm.
You know, because, and not just to separate it out, it's just black history. This is our history.
It's American history. It's American history, absolutely. Absolutely. We all own that history.
And it owns us.
I think it has made us.
That's what I meant, but that's a better way to put it. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask you, so were you as a kid taken with dinosaurs and that whole Jurassic period? Were you?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I cut my teeth, my reading teeth, on science fiction. You know, back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I love science fiction. I was in a science fiction book club. Do you know I had the first edition of Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle? I got it.
And you still have it?
I got it in the 60s when I was a kid. It was first edition, and it got away from me.
Ah.
It got away from me. No, I cut my teeth on science fiction because it would inspire my imagination, my sense of wonder, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it probably led to my becoming a philosopher, you know, getting a PhD in philosophy. I was always looking for that sense of, you know, of mystery. See, here's the thing. You know, we don't know most of what's in the universe. 5% of the universe we can observe, we can measure, right? Stars and galaxies and, you know, trees and so forth. But 95% of the universe consists of dark energy and dark matter, neither one of which we can measure.
Right.
Or observe.
Nor do we really understand. I mean, I think there's other things you bring up in here. The whole question of we can't get into now, but the whole question of alternative universes that Emory Jones explores in this book. We had a wonderful debate on this program between the head of astrophysics here at Morgan State University and an astrophysicist, Hubble, and who disagreed about the question of alternative universes, which was great. But that's another piece of this. That's another part of our world that is mathematically possible that you're also letting Emory Jones talk to us about.
I mean, I want to introduce those really interesting theoretical, you know, kinds of, I guess, speculations that scientists come up with. You know, the scientists right now are the new philosophers. They're raising the old philosophical questions and coming at it, of course, from an empirical, you know, approach. Up for 2,000 years, just about, science and philosophy were the same thing. And then science broke off and it had its own methodologies and so forth. But that sense of mystery, that sense of wonder about the universe in which we find ourselves, that's happening right now in the sciences. Think about 3D printing.
Yeah, oh my God. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just incredible. And almost affordable now for ordinary citizens. You can get yourself a 3D printer for probably a couple of, you know, $2,000, baby.
So I have to ask this question. We have to go, Chuck. The Adventures of Emory Jones, Boy Science Wonder, Bending Time. I have the Reader's Advance copy. When does this hit the bookstores?
2 weeks ago. Well, this is the Book Trope, which is an alternative publisher. That it's an e-book, and it's also in paperback, and it'll be hardback for libraries. Your listeners can get the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes.
And one more time, what is that website you were sending to us earlier in the show?
The website is emorysadventures.com. It's http :// www.emorysadventures, no apostrophe in Emory's, Emery's Adventures.com, .com/
Gotcha. So we'll have that on our website as well.
Fantastic.
The Adventures of Emery Jones, Boy Science Wonder, Bending Time, something for all of our children and all of us to read. I mean, I just went through this book just sitting there on my little comfortable chair in the living room. Which is,
I think you can do it in less than an hour.
You can. You
it's
can.
It's got pictures, too.
It's got pictures as well. by Charles and Elisheba Johnson, his daughter. Illustrations by Charles Johnson. Chuck, thank you so much. Always wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark.
Appreciate you getting up early for us.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Take care. Right. So, folks, this is a book. We will link to it. This is amazing for you and your kids to read together, and we need inspiration. Books like this that Dr. Charles Johnson and his daughter Elisheba put out. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a very new way that's taking hold in Baltimore, Maryland, as an experiment called aging in place. Not moving older people out of their homes, but letting them stay in their homes. It's part of the revolution and what we need to do with seniors rather than shunting people off to old age homes. We'll be right back. Stay with us.